We were talking of synthesis last time. So we had spoken of the present crisis in which a synthesis is inevitable. And therefore we turn to the Gita in order to see whether in the Gita there is any secret of the synthesis. And knowing that secret, whether we can apply it to the present needs. It is in that context that Sri Aurobindo speaks of the synthesis that Indian culture has already had, at least at four important stages. And the first was the Vedic synthesis, of which he spoke last time. The second was the synthesis of the Upanishads. The third is a synthesis of the Bhagavad Gita. And the fourth is a synthesis of the Tantra. And now, we are going to build a new synthesis. Now, what is the synthesis of the Upanishads? The synthesis of the Upanishads was built upon the crowning experience of the Veda. It is as if it takes over what the Veda had to give at its crowning point. And on that, the Bhagavad Gita builds up another synthesis, not necessarily as vast as the Vedic, but in a somewhat specialized manner. It specializes in the methods of the knowledge of the Brahman, the disciplines by which the Brahman can be realized, and there are many methods by which you can do so. And various rishis who had worked on this, both in the Vedic times as also in the times of the Upanishads, all these were synthesized in the Upanishads. Let us repeat. First, there was the crowning experience of the Veda. Now, what was that crowning experience of the Veda? Now, I can't see you, Archanaji. So, what was the crowning experience of the Veda? The crowning experience of the Veda was that of a reality which was the Supreme Being, most transcendental, universal, and individual. An experience of the Supreme which could be said to be transcendental of any possible description. There are many descriptions in the Veda. The Supreme is described as He, described as She, described also as Tat, that simply. Tat Satyam. It was also described as Priyam, full of sweetness. Madhu, full of honey. Many concepts which were in the Veda, such as Hiranyagarbha samavartata agre bhutasya jati patireka asit sadadharam pat, etc. This great concept of Hiranyagarbha, the concept of Virat, the concept of the reality as Prajapati, as a brother, as a friend, as something luminous, powerful. Now these are the various descriptions that we get of the highest experience of the reality. Now all these concepts were put together in the Upanishads. And we get the following formula in the Upanishads in more clear terms. Ekam eva advitiyam. This is one of the concepts in the Upanishads. The one without the second. The one which was even described as asat. One that is sat, that which is also asat in the sense that even to call it sat is to limit it. Therefore, how to deny that that limitation is not to be applied to it? So you call it asat. In the body of the Ishopanishad, a large portion is devoted to avidya and vidya, what is called ignorance and knowledge. And you might say that this is the profoundest Upanishad on the subject of ignorance and knowledge and their interrelationship and the synthesis of avidya and vidya. In fact, the whole of the Upanishad is a tremendous synthesis. At every step, there is a contrast of two opposites and the synthesis. Tena tyaktena bhunjithaha is one of the first contrasts that you get in the Ishopanishad. You renounce and you enjoy. So the synthesis between renunciation and enjoyment is a very starting point at the very first verse of the Ishopanishad. And throughout, avidyaya mrityam tirtva vidyaya amritam ashnute. Avidya is the method by which you cross over the death. But it is by vidya that you enjoy the immortality. So this kind of a contrast between avidya and vidya and the need of one with the other. If you pursue only avidya, you enter into darkness. But if you pursue only vidya, you enter into greater darkness. That is why you should pursue both avidya and vidya. And then when you do that, then you attain to immortality. This is another synthesis that you find. If you take the Keno Upanishad, you find a synthesis of approach to the ultimate reality by exploring the knowledge by senses, knowledge through life processes, and knowledge through the mind. Pranasya pranaha, there is a life behind life. There is a mind behind the mind. And there is sense behind the sense. Shrotrasya shrotram, chakshushaha chakshuhu. There is an ear behind the ear. And there is the eye behind the eye. So this reconciliation of the lower means of knowledge and the higher means of knowledge, this is the whole theme of the issue of the Keno Upanishad. And as you go on with Upanishad after Upanishad, you find varieties of knowledge. As in Katha Upanishad, the knowledge that is given, what happens to one when one dies? Is death really the death? The entire knowledge, the secret of the soul, the secret of soul's passage through the body which dies, and the passage of the soul towards immortality, that whole secret knowledge is given by Yama to Nachiketas in the Katha Upanishad. Again, the emphasis upon the knowledge. If you come to Chandogya Upanishad, you have first the conversation between Sanat Kumar and Narada, where Narada, possessed of all kinds of knowledge, which he describes first of all to his teacher, And if you see the list of the disciplines of knowledge that he describes, there is nothing that he does not know. And yet he says, yet I am not free from sorrow. Therefore give me that knowledge by which I can be liberated from sorrow. And then Sanat Kumar gives that knowledge by which sorrow can be transcended. Or you hear the story of Satyakama Jabali. And when he attains the knowledge of the Brahman glows on his face, as the teacher himself points out to him. Or you hear the conversation between Aruni and Shvetaketu. And Shvetaketu is a young boy, or a grown into a young man, possessed of all knowledge that his teacher had already possessed, and therefore possessed of the belief that there is now nothing left for him to know, or even he surpasses now his own father as far as knowledge is concerned. This is the description of Shvetaketu when he returns from his teacher's house. And then Aruni asks the question, what is it knowing by which everything can be known? And it is this question which develops into a dialogue. And by giving various kinds of analogies, the knowledge that is imparted is Tattvamasi, thou art that. Or you come to Brihadaranyaka Upanishad and dialogues between Yajnavalkya and Maitreyi. Or you come to Mundaka Upanishad or Mandukya Upanishad. The Mandukya Upanishad gives you the description of the state of Jagrata, waking consciousness. The description of the dream state, the Swapna Avastha, the state of sleep, Sushupti Avastha, and the fourth state, the Turiya Avastha, and the secret knowledge of how Om corresponds to these three states, and how at the end of Ma, there is still something left, which is Turiya, correspondent of Turiya Avastha. So in this way, the Upanishads, even while synthesizing karma, jnana and bhakti, the emphasis is not upon that synthesis. Again, in the Vedas, the emphasis was upon the gods and the man and the relationship. Not that this again is absent. In the Isha Upanishad, we have the worship of sun, of Pushan, worship of Agni. In Kena Upanishad, we have reference to Agni, Vayu and Indra. So reference to gods is not absent. But you can see definitely a kind of a departure from the earlier preoccupation with the gods and the Upanishadic occupation with something much different from the gods. Even the gods of the Vedas and the gods of the Upanishads are not on the same plane. The gods of the Upanishads, like the gods like Indra, Varuna and Agni, can forget the divine. In the Vedas, gods never forget the divine. But in this parable of the gods in the Kena Upanishad, they had won the battle. These gods had won the battle and they believed that they had won. And that is why the Supreme manifests itself to remind them. And even then they are not reminded. It is by the intervention of Uma, the Hemavati, who reveals to them that it is the Supreme Lord who is behind them. It is He who has brought them the victory. So you can see the difference between the gods in the Vedas and the gods in the Upanishads. But even then, The Upanishad, Kena Upanishad itself says, Yad Asya Tvam, Yad Asya Deveshu. There are two ways by which you can approach the divine. You can approach the divine through the gods, Yad Asya Deveshu, or you can approach the divine, Yad Asya Tvam, or you can approach through yourself. You go within yourself, that is, you go deeper and deeper in you and conquer your kingdom of body, life and mind by the powers of the soul. Or else, you enlarge yourself and see the movement of gods on the earth, gods in the antariksha, gods in the sky, gods of all the levels of existence, and you discover behind them the Supreme Lord. So, yadasya tvam, yadasya deveshu. And there's a synthesis of these two parts of knowledge in the Kena Upanishad. So you will see now in the Upanishads, therefore, a synthesis of disciplines of knowledge. There are negative disciplines and there are positive disciplines of knowledge. The negative disciplines of knowledge tell you that you are not the body, you are not the life, you are not the mind. This is the knowledge. Normally we think we are the body, life and mind. We are identified with body, life and mind. Therefore the negative path of knowledge or discipline of knowledge is to say, I am not the body, I am not the life, I am not the mind. I am not the ego. I am the Brahman, the Satchidananda. Chidananda Rupa Shivoham, Shivoham. This is the positive method. Negative method is to say, I am not this, I am not this, I am not this. The positive method is to say, I am this, I am this, I am this. So there's a negative method and the positive method. Both are reconciled and synthesized in the Upanishads. Now, this is the great synthesis that you find in the Upanishads, which got into the background, and there came about even a greater and greater emphasis, not on synthesis, but even on exclusive method of knowledge, to emphasize that reality can be attained only by the process of knowledge, and karma and bhakti are subordinated. A stage was reached in India. And if you study the Bhagavad Gita, you will find that the perplexity of Arjuna is centered on this important question. Is not the path of knowledge the supreme path, the only path? Is not renunciation the only path? And he argues in favor of that. That is because in the environment of the Mahabharata, this theory must have been very prominent. Otherwise, why should Arjuna be so perplexed about it? It is because in the course of time, from the Upanishads, the disciplines of knowledge which were synthesized, even when it is synthesized also karma, bhakti and jnana, there was a gradual emphasis on knowledge. And it became so powerful as to say that all other methods may prepare you, but they do not deliver you. It is the knowledge which can deliver you. And as a result of that, there was some kind of ambiguity in the atmosphere. And people were arguing in favor of this or that or that. And if you read the Bhagavad Gita, you will find a tremendous churning of various trends of thought. There was a belief that without Vedic karma, you cannot attain the highest. That also was a theory present. And that is why Sri Krishna deals with that problem also. The distinction between Vedic karma and the real karma. Sri Krishna, at that time there was a kind of a conflict between Sankhya and Yoga. Yoga was supposed to be a path of action. And Sankhya was supposed to be the path of knowledge. The word Sankhya and Yoga do not mean in the Bhagavad Gita the same as what is now meant by the word Sankhya and Yoga. In due course of time, even the word Sankhya and Yoga, their meanings have changed. But in the Bhagavad Gita, the word Sankhya means the path of knowledge, and Yoga means a path of action which is consistent with knowledge and bhakti. But these two elements subordinated. But that we shall see when we come to further details of the Bhagavad Gita. But for the moment, it is important to notice that by the time that we come to the Bhagavad Gita, to the time of Mahabharata, the idea that knowledge is the real method of salvation, of liberation, and that all others are to be subordinated or to be surpassed, this had become very prominent, so prominent that Arjuna's main difficulty arose from it. He wanted to renounce the battlefield on the plea that battlefield is a field of action. And action ultimately is to be of no consequence. It doesn't lead you to the ultimate goal. Therefore, I leave it and I will take sannyas. I will renounce the world and enter into the path of knowledge. And attain to the highest. And that was his basic argument. And Sri Krishna deals with this question in depth. And while dealing with this question, and this is the speciality of the Bhagavad Gita, it synthesizes knowledge, action and devotion. This is the speciality of Bhagavad Gita. This kind of synthesis you don't find anywhere in the history of the world. The synthesis of karma, jnana and bhakti, with a special emphasis upon action. As Sri Aurobindo says, Bhagavad Gita is the highest gospel of karma yoga. You will never find anywhere the statement of karma yoga as clearly and as potently as it is in the Bhagavad Gita. So this is a new synthesis. You don't find that synthesis either in the Veda or in the Upanishad. It's a new synthesis required by the needs of the time. In due course, however, even this went into the background. Even this synthesis went into the background. And there arose then a conflict of different claims. The bhaktas claim that bhakti is the only path. The jnanis claim that jnana is the only path. Vedkandis believe that only karma kanda is the only path. Or karma yogins believe that only karma is the only path. So there was a period of great conflict, claims and counterclaims. This conflict even now subsists, even today it subsists in a very powerful manner. Even the Bhagavad Gita's teaching has been interpreted by bhaktas saying that Bhagavad Gita teaches only bhakti. Bhagavad Gita is taught in such a way as to say that it teaches only Gyan Marga. Or others who say that it teaches only Karma Marga. So even Bhagavad Gita's synthesis has now come to be so interpreted as to become an exclusive teaching, either for this or for that or for that. In the meantime, there arose in the Indian history another synthesis, and that is a synthesis of Tantra. Now the speciality of the Tantra is a synthesis of supreme as both masculine and feminine. It's a speciality, the synthesis of the masculine and the feminine principles of existence, which was present in the Veda. As I said, the Veda describes the reality both as he and she, both as Vrishabha and Dhenu. Vrishabha is the bull and Dhenu is the cow. That was already in the Veda. That synthesis was present. But that synthesis was not so marked out so very emphasized, as the tantrics came to do. And they came to Amphitrite, is dual in character, although it is one, it is dual in character. And not only that, it came to emphasize a further point, that it is a feminine principle which can ultimately take you to the Supreme Lord. If you want to enter into the portals of the Supreme Lord, you can do only with the grace, with the favor, kripa, of the Supreme Mother, of the Divine Mother. Therefore, the entire worship of the Mother is a special characteristic of Tantra. So there is a synthesis, no doubt, of the Supreme Lord and the Divine Mother. But this synthesis has got one kind of emphasis. In fact, there is one school of Tantra which says that Supreme Mother is even superior to the Lord, because Lord is entirely at the mercy of the Supreme Mother. The Supreme Lord will do nothing unless he is completely controlled by the Supreme Mother. So even in Tantra there are various kinds of formulations, and one of them again becomes exclusive to this extent, emphasizing that it is only through the Divine Mother. In fact, the main distinction between Vedantic yoga and the Tantric yoga rests on this, that according to Vedantic yoga, the emphasis falls upon the principle of the soul and the self for entering into the higher from the lower. In the Tantra, the emphasis falls upon the power, not soul and self, but upon power, upon Shakti. It is through Shakti and by development of Shakti that you enter into the Supreme Lord. It is almost a kind of a reflection of the two paths of which you spoke in the Kena Upanishad. Yadascha Tvam, Yadascha Deveshu. Both the paths were there, but here it is even much more manifestly said in the Tantra. The Tantra also discovers the sleeping Shakti in our own body, called Kundalini, and points out that this Shakti is already in you. And if you can awaken this Shakti, this Kundalini, then by a very special process, it can rise, it can awaken, and then join with the Supreme Shakti that is above. And through that realization of the joining, of the union, you can then enter into the portals of the Supreme Lord. So this is a very special method that you find in the Tantric Yoga. The awakening of Kundalini, and in doing so, they took the help of both Hatha Yoga and Raj Yoga. These two yogas also are united, and the entire process of Kundalini is awakening was assisted by the methods of Hatha Yoga and Raj Yoga. It also unites the processes of Jnana, Bhakti and Karma, because the worship of Shakti requires the worship of Jnana Shakti, Karma Shakti, and also Shakti which comes by devotion. So an emphasis upon a synthesis of Jnana, Karma and Bhakti, synthesis of Raja Yoga and Hatha Yoga, and a very bold experiment in which the so-called obstacles in the yoga were themselves utilized as aids in yoga. The theory is that whatever obstructs you in the path, instead of avoiding the obstruction, you embrace it and take out the truth of it, utilize it for your higher development. If anger is your obstruction, then develop the anger that is behind anger. Develop Kali Bhava. Instead of only being angry now and then, develop the Kali Bhava, which is a very great achievement. If you can have a Kali Bhava which does not tolerate any kind of obstacle, any kind of impurity whatsoever, with a sword you stand and impetuously you fight and destroy the enemies. So even anger can be used if you develop this power as your method of liberation. So according, they took a very powerful attitude towards all the obstacles and said, "You, whatever is your obstacle, you take it in your hands and liberate its power, develop its power, because there is no obstacle which has no power behind it. And that power ultimately is a divine power. Therefore, take it to its extreme logic and develop it." It's a powerful experiment made by tantrics. Develop your body, develop your life, develop your mind capacities. Develop bhakti, karma, jnana. Awaken kundalini. And achieve a very powerful development in which Shakti and Purusha, Purushottama stand together. And you become the vehicle of that Supreme Purusha and Prakriti.
Isn't that a great risk in this, in the first stages of...
Very big risk, of course.
Surely.
Not only small risk, it is a complete risk. That is why people do not recommend Tantra normally. And Tantrics themselves test you tremendously before you are admitted to Tantra. Because it's a very, very dangerous, very risky, but... It was bold because it undertook this experiment. Even India's greatness is that there is nothing which India did not attempt. Like scientists of highest order, they said, well, if these are the problems, let us face them and make tremendous experiments. How much risk they must have incurred in their process? How many must have been failures in this process? Even to develop this theory, today we can talk of this theory as if it's a child's play. But to develop this theory, to say with assurance that these obstacles can be turned into opportunities, can be turned into means of your achievement. Even today we say so confidently, but how can you say without experimenting? So you can imagine what a tremendous experiment India must have attempted and how much achievement India must have done to say today with confidence that yes, if you do this, this will be the result. But this is what was done by the tantrics. That is why also tantra fell, because to sustain the tantra, very few can be fit for it. But when you try to popularize it, seeing the dangers in it, and people succumb to the dangers also. And that is why tantra went into disrepute. But there are three elements of this great experiment which can be regarded as a kind of a synthesis. First, a synthesis of this concept of the divine as the male and the female at the same time. Secondly, the synthesis of karma yoga, jnana yoga, bhakti yoga, kriya yoga and raj yoga. Second synthesis. And third, the synthesis of the powers of the body, life and mind with the powers of the Supreme Shakti and even the idea of the perfectibility of man, so that on all sides the human being can be integrated. And finally, a synthesis between the idea of individual liberation and collective liberation. These are the elements of synthesis that we find in Tantra. But even this synthesis is not enough for the present day. The kind of synthesis that we now need is a total synthesis. Even the small emphasis that were put, like in the Upanishad, the emphasis on knowledge, even though synthesis of disciplines of knowledge, but it's emphasis on knowledge, that has to be worked out as to bring it into a greater synthesis of that synthesis of knowledge with the synthesis of karma, with the synthesis of bhakti. The kind of synthesis that we find in Tantra also has to be synthesized with this. A total synthesis. And that is why Sri Aurobindo speaks in the last paragraph of this chapter, the kind of synthesis that we need is unprecedented. A total synthesis of all the parts of the being, of all aspects of reality, of all the methods of yoga, an achievement not only of human perfectibility, but even surpassing of humanity. To emphasize that human problems of today cannot be resolved by even by human perfection. You require a new kind of perfection, supramental perfection. This is the need. So when we are trying to make a preparation for that great synthesis, in that process, our understanding of the Gita will play a major role. It's not as if study of Gita is enough. Study of the Gita will give you a kind of a key which will be extremely important. In fact, over the end of the book, Sri Aurobindo says, it is not as if all the solutions that you are looking for are in the Gita. But the central key is there. And we must find out what is the central key. Uttamam Rahasyam. This is the Bhagavad Gita's Uttamam Rahasyam that is there in the Bhagavad Gita. And unless you discover that Uttamam, that supreme secret, you will not be able to make the kind of synthesis that we want to have. Let us now read this last two paragraphs of this chapter. You have page number 9, no, in your book. There have been other syntheses in the long history of Indian thought. We start with the Vedic synthesis of the psychological being of man in its highest flights and widest rangings of divine knowledge, power, joy, life and glory, with the cosmic existence of the gods, pursued behind the symbols of the material universe, into those superior planes which are hidden from the physical sense and the material mentality. The crown of this synthesis was in the experience of the Vedic rishis, something divine, transcendent and blissful, in whose unity the increasing soul of man and the eternal divine fullness of the cosmic Godheads meet perfectly and fulfill themselves. The Upanishads take up this crowning experience of the earlier seers and make it their starting point for a high and profound synthesis of spiritual knowledge. They draw together into a great harmony all that had been seen and experienced by the inspired and liberated knowers of the Eternal throughout a great and fruitful period of spiritual seeking. The Gita starts from this Vedantic synthesis, and upon the basis of its essential ideas, builds up another harmony of the three great means and powers, love, knowledge and works, through which the soul of man can directly approach and cast itself into the Eternal. There is yet another, the Tantric, which though less subtle and spiritually profound, is even more bold and forceful than the synthesis of the Gita. For it seizes even upon the obstacles to the spiritual life and compels them to become the means for a richer spiritual conquest and enables us to embrace the whole of life in our divine scope as the Leela of the Divine. And in some directions, it is more immediately rich and fruitful, for it brings forward into the foreground, along with the divine knowledge, divine works, and enriched devotion of divine love, the secrets also of the Hatha and Raja Yogas, the use of the body and of mental ascesis for the opening up of the divine life on all its planes, to which the Gita gives only a passing and perfunctory attention. Moreover, it grasps at that idea of the divine perfectibility of man, possessed by the Vedic rishis, but thrown into the background by the intermediate ages, which is destined to fill so large a place in any future synthesis of human thought, experience, and aspiration. We of the coming day stand at the head of a new age of development, which must lead to such a new and larger synthesis. We are not called upon to be orthodox Vedantins of any of the three schools, or tantrics, or to adhere to one of the theistic religions of the past, or to entrench ourselves within the four corners of the teaching of the Gita. That would be to limit ourselves and to attempt to create our spiritual life out of the being, knowledge, and nature of others, of the men of the past, instead of building it out of our own being and potentialities. We do not belong to the past dawns, but to the noons of the future. A mass of new material is flowing into us. We have not only to assimilate the influences of the great theistic religions of India and of the world, and a recovered sense of the meaning of Buddhism, but to take full account of the potent, though limited, revelations of modern knowledge and seeking. And beyond that, the remote and dateless past, which seemed to be dead, is returning upon us with an effulgence of many luminous secrets long lost to the consciousness of mankind, but now breaking out again from behind the veil. All this points to a new, a very rich, a very vast synthesis, a fresh and widely embracing harmonization of our gains is both an intellectual and a spiritual necessity of the future. But just as the past synthesis have taken those which preceded them for their starting point, so also must that of the future, to be on firm ground, proceed from what the great bodies of realized spiritual thought and experiences in the past have given. Among them, the Gita takes a most important place. Our object then in studying the Gita will not be a scholastic or academical scrutiny of its thought, not to place its philosophy in the history of metaphysical speculation, nor shall we deal with it in the manner of the analytical dialectician. We approach it for help and light, and our aim must distinguish its essential and living message, that in it on which humanity has to seize for its perfection and its highest spiritual welfare. So this is our starting point of the study of the Gita. This is the spirit in which we are going to study. And now we come to the real beginning of the study of the Gita. But even the real study of the Gita is prefaced by three important propositions. Because There are three most important elements in the Gita. The teacher, Shri Krishna himself, Arjuna, the pupil, and the occasion, the battle of Kurukshetra. And all the three have symbolic meaning and significance, and also the significance of their actuality. The actuality of the situation is to be measured by the fact that the Bhagavad Gita is a part of a great battle. And it is directly related to our life because we ourselves are in a battle. Not many people realize the force of this battle in which we are gripped today. But whether we like it or not, we are in a battle. And that is why wherever you turn, we have problems and series of problems. One problem you resolve, another problem faces us. You resolve it, another problem faces us, and so on. Why is it that we are living in a world where there's plethora of problems, one after the other? And we don't know how to deal with the series of problems. It is almost like Abhimanyu going into the seven circles. You pass one, you come into the second. You come to the second, you go to the third. And even if you reach the seventh, you do not know how to return. Such is the present situation. And that is why the significance of the Gita for us. Why Gita is so near to us? Because the Gita is not written as a book like the Upanishad or the Veda, which in the tranquility of your hours of life, you can turn to meditate and contemplate. Here you don't even have the time to contemplate. You are in the midst of the battle. Arjuna was given no time at all to face the problem and to find the solution to the problem. Something like what we are obliged to do in our life. So the occasion, the actuality in which the Gita is fixed, is presented, is a very dynamic reality. And the problem that has been raised in the Gita is not an ordinary problem. As Sri Aurobindo says, no such great book like the Gita could have been written if it was to solve only an ordinary problem. It is only because the problem is one of the naughtiest problems that a great teaching bursts out to solve that problem. So this occasion, however, has two important figures involved in it. Historically, there is, we might say, a warrior and a charioteer. A warrior who was convinced that the problems that were faced by him, by his family, by his clan, by his nation, by the country, by the people, could be resolved only if you fight out a war. He was convinced of this. And it is with that conviction that Arjuna, the great warrior, enters into the battlefield. And with a heavy and proud head, he asks his charioteer, Sri Krishna, to place him at a point where he can see all the armies which were arranged in the battle and with whom he has to fight and to slay. And Krishna is the advisor, inspirer, but a charioteer. In a sense, the closest to the warrior, even physically. Nobody can be so close to a warrior unless he becomes his charioteer. Happily, such a relationship obtained. Now, there are many questions which have been raised. And as Sri Aurobindo says, we shall not deal with those questions, because they are not of great significance to us. The one question was, did Mahabharata take place at all? Is it simply a dramatic fiction written by some author or by several authors? Or did it actually take place? And on this so much has been written that if you enter into that field, our main purpose in reading the Gita will be lost. And we need not deal with it, because even if such a war did not take place, even if you take it as a dramatic fiction, what is important is what the Gita teaches, the occasion that it paints, even if maybe an imaginary painting. The important point is whether such a problem that faced Arjuna would not realistically face anybody in the world. And if that is shown to be true, it is enough for us that there was such a problem did arise even to an imaginary character like Arjuna. And that this problem was dealt with a great force of knowledge and power, even though in imagination. But if that knowledge and power are really verifiable, experienceable, and if it is really going to help us, then even if it's a dramatic fiction, it doesn't matter at all. So why should you waste our time in discussing whether it did happen or not happen? Not that that problem is no importance, but we are not concerned with it. We are not turning to the Gita for that purpose. It is we. As Sri Aurobindo says, our demand and need from the Gita is not from that point of view. It is a historical discussion, which is always good. You can have scholars, you can have 100 scholars put up and see the Bhagavad Gita, see the archaeological excavations and so on. You can make lot of inquiry about it, compare one history with the history of another country and so on. Fine, but that is not our purpose. There is a question whether Bhagavad Gita was a part of the original Mahabharata or whether it was interpolated into the Mahabharata. This is also another question. There are many scholars who debate on this question. Some believe that Mahabharata, as originally written, did include Bhagavad Gita as its part. Some believe that some later on, as the story developed gradually, some philosopher wrote Bhagavad Gita, and in order to give a great value to it, he interpolated his old book into Mahabharata. And that is how they believe that, actually speaking, the value of Bhagavad Gita is reduced because it was not a part of the original Mahabharata. Also, it is claimed that there would have been no time left at the time of the war when Arjuna could have put this question and then Sri Krishna took him aside and had the time and patience to give a discourse on such a very difficult subject, which even we would take years to understand. And that is supposed to have been done even before the war actually started, when all the warriors were ready to fight. So this question also has been raised. Now, this also can be answered in many ways. It can be said that the dialogue originally may be very short, but after all, the author wrote at length. Another is that there are many dialogues which take place internally. Just as in a dream, your dream may be only for 2 minutes, but it may take a look as if only 2 hours events can take place in 2 minutes dream. That also is possible. Or it may be that really, when you really write down what has happened, it may look long, but actually that conversation doesn't take so long. We know that even by, if you write a minutes of a particular meeting, the minutes may run into 150 pages. But it may be an account only of 1 hour. Reading 50 pages may take you 2-3 hours. But actually when it happens, it takes only 1 hour. It's quite possible that it also happened in the same way. But Sri Aurobindo says, all these questions are for us not important. What is important is whether what is contained in the Gita, the questions and answers which are recorded in the Gita, whether they are significant questions and significant answers. Whether these questions echo your questions. Echo your questions arising out of your situation. Arising out of your need. And whether the answers given give you any guidance to your questions. If this is so, it is enough for you to study the Gita. And that is why we study the Gita. There is also a question whether Sri Krishna ever lived on the earth. That also is another question. Because people say that if Krishna never existed at all, the question of Mahabharata does not arise, the question of war does not arise, the question of question doesn't arise, the question of answering his questions do not arise. The whole Gita seems to be only a kind of a literature, a dramatic fiction, which can be studied if you have leisure and time, but otherwise it has no significance. Just as the questions have been raised about Jesus, reading the whole New Testament, many people ask the question whether Jesus ever existed. Whether Jesus was born here or there, Bethlehem or Jerusalem or wherever, or whether he was really charged of sedition and ultimately was crucified. All these questions have been raised even about Christ. And Sri Aurobindo's answer is that even this question is not so relevant to us. The question again is whether a personality like Sri Krishna can really exist. Whether he existed or not is a different question. But whether such a personality can exist or not. Whether Krishna described as avatar can possibly exist or not. Whether avatar itself is a concept which is justified or not. And if avatar ever exists, not Sri Krishna, but if anywhere, if avatar existed or can come into existence, then by his actions he can explain to us what is the purpose of avatar and what is the role of avatar in the world. In the history of the world, if at all there is any role. It is that inner question which is most important. And therefore when we turn to the Gita, we need not waste our time on these questions. But Sri Aurobindo points out one or two important facts. And he gives his own view. He says, first of all, that the Bhagavad Gita is not an interpolation. If you read the Bhagavad Gita, you find that it is so woven with the entire book, it doesn't look as if it were outer organ and transplanted into the center of Bhagavad Gita, of the Mahabharata. Or he says that even if it is an outer thing, it is so interwoven so powerfully that the occasion is constantly referred to in the Bhagavad Gita. The occasion of the war and the insistence of Sri Krishna that the war is on and that he has to take part in it. Reminding the reader, reminding Arjuna all the time of the occasion in which it arose. It is not as if somebody wrote some poem outside and then he just juxtaposed it into it. Again, Sri Aurobindo says that Sri Krishna was certainly a historical figure in the history of India. If you take, for example, the Upanishad, the Chandogya Upanishad, which is quite an indifferent source, there is a mention that a rishi called Ghora, Angirasa. He gave knowledge to Sri Krishna, the son of Devaki, which is clearly mentioned. Gaura gave this knowledge to son of Krishna, the son of Devaki. In the same Upanishad, the name of Dhritarashtra also occurs. So it means that historically, these two personalities who were so closely associated with each other in the Mahabharata are independently corroborated in the Upanishad. In fact, I thought that it might interest you, exact quotation from Chandogya Upanishad, where this particular mention of Krishna is made. So if you can give to everyone a copy of this, it might interest you that historic, that there is an evidence. I have still three more copies here. That's why I brought it here. Precisely for that reason, that we may know, like to know, what was the knowledge that was given to Sri Krishna by Gaura. If you read page number 115, the verse number 6 on page number 115, this is taken from Chandogya Upanishad. The verse number 6 you see there, Gaura, son of Angiras, having explained this subject to Krishna, son of Devaki, said as follows. Now what has gone before is explained, and which I am not at present reading out to you, because it is a symbolic writing and may require another kind of explanation and detailed understanding, but we shall see later on if necessary. But what is important now is this. He said, he who knows this should at the time of his death repeat these three Yajurvedic mantras. O thou art undecaying, thou art unchanging, thou art the true essence of life. Hearing this, he, that is Krishna, lost all desire for other knowledge. He was illumined. And about it, there are these two Rigvedic stanzas. Now, this is a very significant thing. To be able to make us understand what was the knowledge that was given to Sri Krishna is actually contained here. Sages behold the glory of the first cause as enveloping all like the day and shedding radiance from the heaven above. Having beheld that exquisite light high above all darkness, and having beheld it also in our own hearts, we attain to that God of gods and noblest of all lights, the sun, the noblest of all lights. Now, this translation is, according to me, very inadequate, doesn't bring out very fully. But let us try to read. This is the one sentence in Sanskrit we shall read first. Udvayam tamasaspari suha pashyanta uttaram devam devatra suryam aganma jyotiruttama. This is the Sanskrit text. Udvayam tamasaspari pashyanta uttaram. Udvayam tamasaspari, that is to say, tamasaspari, beyond the darkness, jyotihi pashyanta uttaram. There was a higher light. Uttara means higher. Uttamam is the highest. Uttaram is the higher. Beyond the darkness was perceived, pashyanta, uttaram jyotihi, was perceived the higher light. That was the first step. This was the description of the Vedic knowledge, that there is darkness in this world, but the Vedic rishis made experiments and found out that this is not the end of the world. There is darkness, but there is also a kind of a knowledge. There is light, of which we are not aware, but if you make an experiment, you will see the light. This is the first secret which is given. Udvayam tamasaspari pashanta uttaram jyotihi. Then, devam devatra suryam aganma. Beyond jyoti is surya. That is to say, beyond jyoti, which is just beyond the darkness, which is also called swaha. If you read this, the whole sentence, you will see the word swaha also there. Udvayam tamasaspari jyotihi pashanta uttara swaha. So, there is swaha. It is from there the word swarga and all this has come. Beyond this world of darkness, there is a realm of jyoti, of light. But beyond that, devam devatra suryamaganma. But then the gods were approached, and the supreme god was approached, which is described as Surya, the supreme light. Jyotihi uttamam. If you see the last phrase, it is written jyotir uttamam iti, jyotir uttamam iti. The uttama light, not only uttaram light, but uttamam light. The supreme light was seen. Now it is a revelation of three things. The world is a world of darkness. Beyond that there is a world of light. But beyond that there is the world of the supreme light. It is when you realize these three things that you don't need anything more to know. All that is to be known is known. Knowing which everything is known. Yasmin gyate sarvam gyatam bhavati. That there is a distinction between the higher light and the highest light. Even this is a distinction which is very important to make. Not many people make a distinction. When they see light, they say, I have seen light. That is the final term. But to know that there are different grades of light, as in the Isha Upanishad, it is said that there is a golden lid which is hiding the supreme light. And the supreme light is the light of the sun. Pushan apavrino. It is addressed to Pushan. Pushan is the growing sun. It's the name of the sun. So, as in the Isha Upanishad, also the highest knowledge is given, where the supreme form of light was made effulgent by breaking the lid, which was golden, and which you might be tempted not to break it, because it seems so bright and so beautiful, so golden. Hiranmayena patrena. It was so much golden that to break it was a great task. So swaha jyotihi is the jyoti of this golden lid. And beyond that is the highest light. It is this knowledge which Sri Krishna was given by Gaura, and having got it, he said, I am now illumined. So this is given in the Chandogya Upanishad itself. So that there was a Krishna who was the son of Devaki and who was an illumined man. And in a sense you might say that if the Bhagavad Gita has a supreme secret, this is a supreme secret. In the whole Bhagavad Gita, the real teaching is contained here itself. Sri Krishna gave this teaching to Arjuna, that there is a rahasyam, there is Guhyataram Rahasyam, and there is Guhyatamam Rahasyam. So, Guhyam Rahasyam, Guhyataram Rahasyam, and Guhyatamam Rahasyam. These are the three secrets of the Gita, and that sums up the whole of the Gita. So, the Guhyam Rahasyam is only this, that what you are seeing is not all. That is Guhyam Rahasyam. Guhyataram Rahasyam is that there is a higher light, Swaha. Guhyatamam Rahasyam is that there is a supreme light. And that light is the light of the sun. Now what the word sun meant, if you want to understand the significance of sun, then of course you have to read the whole of the Veda. It is because this knowledge was prevalent at that time. When the word sun was used, it was understood what is the meaning of sun. It is a sun in which all the rays of light can be combined together like a laser beam. Laser beam, today laser, if you speak, people understand what is the meaning of it. Similarly, at that time the sun was one in which all the rays of light can be marshaled together. And when you attain to that knowledge, there is nothing which is dark. The darkness is completely dispelled. Now, this is a historical fact given in the Upanishad. It's an independent body. Therefore, there will be no surprise that if Krishna existed, that if Krishna was the son of Devaki, and if he happened to give a knowledge on the battlefield to Arjuna, there will be no surprise at all, even historically. And if the knowledge which is contained in this verse of Chandogya Upanishad is actually the sum and substance of the whole of the Gita. If this is a fact, then why should there be any doubt about the fact that Sri Krishna gave this knowledge to Arjuna? I think we should stop here today.